Good morning, good afternoon. Please go ahead. This call is now being recorded.
Thank you, Francesca. Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. This is the PPSAI Working Group call on the 31st of March, 2015. On the call today, we have Volker Greeman, Graham Bunton, Sarah Wild, Steve Metellus, James Gannon, Val Sherman, James Bledel, Todd Williams, Paul McGrady, Alex Deacon, Justin Macy, Stephanie Perrin, Griffin Barnett, Dick Leaney, Kathy Kleiman, and Darcy Southwell. I show apologies from Holly Raich, Don Blumenthal, Victoria Scheckler, and Lindsay Hamilton Reed. From staff, we have Mary Wong, Marika Koning, Amy Bivens, and myself, Terry Agnew. I would like to remind all participants to please state your name before speaking for transcription purposes. Thank you very much, and back over to you, Steve.
Thank you, and welcome everyone. We've had a very lively exchange on the list over the last, especially over the last 24 or fewer hours. I think we need to reflect that in some a little bit of a change to our agenda. But I would just like to ask people to be sure to take a deep breath before you speak or write. Sometimes we get a little distracted by the rhetorical flourishes that many of us, and I certainly include myself in this number, like to include in our very eloquent and persuasive comments. So we need to look a little bit past that, get to the merits of what's being discussed, and try to engage on that level. So I would just encourage people to be conscious of that today on the call and also in the discussion on the list, which I think has moved the process forward. And that's why I would like to suggest a little bit of a modification to our agenda. First of all, I will just ask if anyone wants to give an oral update to their statement of interest. I see we have James Gannon, a new participant in the working group. Welcome, James. But does anybody have an update to the statement of interest that they want to share? Okay, thank you. So in terms of the agenda, I would like to – I think we've had a discussion on this agency question that we probably need to continue a little bit here, even though we had had a slightly different approach in the written agenda. I think we – are circling around three issues here. I'm calling them the three A's, and they the first is attestation, the second is automation, and the third is the annex, which was what was up on your screen. They all get to this question, I think, of trying to reduce the risk of frivolous or baseless, let's say, requests. I think the attestation piece, we've had a lot of discussion about whether the person making the request has to have a certain title or specify a certain relationship to the trademark owner or copyright owner. I think the discussion has moved on somewhat to looking at whether what we already have in the draft, if you look at, for example, template 2A, or 2B, where you have to state under penalty of perjury that you're the trademark owner or authorized representative of the trademark holder, does that need to be fleshed out some more or clarified? So that's the attestation piece of that to guard against, unauthorized requests. The second, I would say, is the automation piece, which has come out in a lot of the comments about from those who think we need something stronger on attestation. They're concerned about automated requests that are being pumped out. No one's looking at them, creating a lot of perhaps unnecessary work, but also increasing the risk of a false positive, if you will, of a baseless request, a request that doesn't meet the criteria. So automation is another aspect of this, and I noticed that Todd has put some language up on the list, and it'd be interesting to get people's reaction to that. And the third is the annex, which we haven't really talked about very much at all. And the goal of the annex was to provide some, which grew out of the original proposal that several from the IPC and from the service providers had worked out, was to provide some options for dealing with a situation, hopefully a rare one, in which there is a disclosure, but it turns out to have been based on some type of false information, and what would be the remedy for that. So that's what the annex, which was to be our first agenda item originally, addresses. But I think these are all kind of parts of the same puzzle. What do you have to show in terms of attestation to show that you have the authority and you've actually have done some due diligence on this domain name and how it's being used before you make a request for disclosure? Second, automation, should we be doing something to make sure that this system is not drowned by automated requests? And then third, the annex, what if despite those two, something based on false information gets through the system and something is improperly revealed? So I would encourage us to focus on those things for a little while. We do want to get to the other main topic here, which is a suggestion on 3C, or a couple of suggestions on 3C, which are the non-exhaustive list of reasons that disclosure can be denied. But since we've had so much discussion about this agency point or attestation point, I wondered if people could focus first on that, if they have some suggestions about how to deal with attestation or this automation question, which seemed to be linked, and then we can turn to the annex. So I will open the floor for comments on those topics. Seeing no hands, and since I think Todd is on the call, Todd, would you like to just, because not everyone necessarily had been looking at the list in the few minutes leading up to this, would you like to explain your suggestion with regard to automated requests or automated responses?
Sure. Thank you. Todd Williams for the transcript. So in looking at a lot of the discussion that we have had on this question on the table, I was trying to think of a proposal that would address this automation concern but do so in a way that would not implicate or run into a lot of the issues that I think are legitimate that have been raised by Susan, Kieran, and others. And so I put forward some draft language. I suggested that it be added to the preamble, but certainly there's no magic to that. And I would add, I'm not, wedded to that language. I see Paul, for one, has already offered a tweak to it, which I think is a good one, and certainly I would accept. So, we can dive into discussing the language itself if, as a group, we think that's a good idea, or if there is, I guess, discussion on whether this is a route we want to go down at all, we probably ought to have that first before we get into the wordsmithing. But I just say that to note that I have no particular, affinity for that language. I'm certainly happy to talk about that.
Okay, thank you, Todd. Again, just because I know not everyone has seen this language, I've just put it in the chat within quotes. This is what Todd circulated, within the past hour or so. And as he said, this is a starting point. But just so you understand what we're talking about here, it's to add a sentence to the preamble and saying, given the importance of these interests and given the nature of the balance that this policy strikes, evidence of the use of automation, i.e., the absence of human review by any of the parties involved, requesters, service providers, or customers, to complete any of the steps in the process as outlined below, shall create a rebuttable presumption of noncompliance with this policy. So it's to try to discourage, this is an area, unlike the relay area that we talked about in the past, this is an area where I think everyone seems to agree that it's very difficult to automate this disclosure process in many cases. So this is the language that Todd has put forward. I see James has his hand up, and will anybody else that wants to get in the queue to discuss this, please put your hand up.
Steve, this is Kieran. I'm not in Adobe Connect, but can I please be in the queue?
Yes, you can. I have James, Kathy, and Kieran. Go ahead, James.
Hi, good morning. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello?
Yes.
Okay, great. Hi, James speaking for the transcript. Thanks, Steve. And I fully admit right out of the gate that I checked in on this thread late last week, and I probably am woefully behind on all of the traffic that's going on. So I'm kind of sticking my neck out there a little bit on the possibility that all of this has been discussed to death, and I'm unknowingly poking a hornet's nest. But I think that the language proposed by Todd is good and gets us a lot closer. I want to make sure that it doesn't rule out any automation, for example, the processing and routing of tickets depending upon the nature of the complaint. Obviously, there would still need to be a human review at some point in the process, but want to ensure that that automation is defined as zero human review, not some automation. And then just thinking out here a little bit, I would go back to the RAA, which I know that we've used as a parallel document for some of the requirements for privacy providers, that does have similar restrictions and warnings relative to accessing WHOIS data, and essentially saying, you know, that registrars, in this case, can impose limits and terms on the use and access of their WHOIS systems, you know, so long as it doesn't I don't have the exact language in front of me. Something about, you know, preventing high volume automated processes that send a lot of traffic to registry or registrar systems. And I think we could probably borrow some of that language to address the concerns about automation. Is just essentially say that, look, you know, providers are free to implement things like capture or whatever to prevent that automated high-volume process. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, James. Kathy?
Hi, can you hear me, Steve?
I can.
Okay, good morning, good evening, all. I just wanted to make sure that what we're talking about is this language and not a replacement, this language in addition to but not as a replacement to the other types of signatory issues or attestation issues, as you call them, that we've already been talking about. It's very important to prevent automation, but that's not the sum total of the issue that we're talking about. I think there was a really robust discussion last time about the difference between authorized representative and authorized legal representative, and I'm not going to go into it now. I just want to make sure that we're saving that time because there's been a great discussion on the list about that and about our concerns, not just about who's submitting this request and making sure that they have the standing in the background to make the infringement allegation, or that whoever's signing it, not necessarily whoever's writing the letter, but whoever's signing it has that, because they're also the ones receiving this personal or sensitive data. So I just wanted to make sure, I think everyone probably agrees on the automation, and we can work on the language to reflect, you know, the nuances so it doesn't capture the wrong things. But I just wanted to make sure we're not replacing the larger issue. Thanks, Steve.
Okay, thank you, Kathy. Yes, this is one of the A's, and they're all interlinked, but they're not identical. I think Kieran was next, and then I see Todd in the queue. So, Kieran, please go ahead.
Hi, thanks, Keith. I think that actually James may have captured a little bit of the question I want to raise, which is a question about what do you mean by automation. I guess I'm not entirely sure what the service providers are attempting to restrict. I think Paul made a good point on the list about, you know, how brand owners, sorry, I have a baby in the background. I apologize for the noise. Paul raised a good point on the list about how brand owners send complaints and how that may be through kind of an automated service or some sort of kind of digital kind of dashboard that helps us keep track of, you know, what we're sending and to whom and at what stage is that. And I want to make sure that whatever process that we put in place to restrict automation, that we don't actually eliminate the convenience of those kinds of systems. from the, you know, brand owner's repertoire. And I think that that James kind of already addressed that. But going forward, let's be very, very clear about what we mean so that we know exactly what we're restricting. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. I see Todd, and again, if anybody else wants to get in the queue, please raise your hand, or if you're not in the Adobe room, please speak up. So, Todd, please go ahead.
Well, just quickly, I did intend this draft language as a substitute for some of the thornier issues that we were getting into in terms of, notice having to come from, I think it was a VP or an attorney or things like that. Certainly we can, break apart attestation and automation and discuss the two separately, and that maybe is helpful because I think in some of our discussion or in some of the emails, they were getting lumped together, and it may be that they have different, solutions to either one. I think others on the group have raised some of the issues of requiring notice to come from, certainly or from a certain high level, and that was what this language was intended to get to.
Thank you. Any other comments on automation at this point? Obviously, people have just gotten this language, and I think everyone agrees there's certainly some tweaking, but I do hear a certain degree of support for the concept. So I would encourage Todd and others to work offline and try to refine this language and make sure it isn't, doesn't capture things we're not trying to capture. And I think James had a good suggestion as to whether that language has been in the RAA forever about high-volume automated processes. Is that something that could slide in here as well? So I think there's good, at least so far, a good level of agreement on this. Let me get back to the attestation question and whether this is a substitute for that, which obviously we have differences of opinion on. But let me ask folks, if you would, just take a look at what we have in the document now regarding, in the basic document regarding attestation. And if you look, for example, in paragraph, in the what's on your screen, if you look on page 3, paragraph 6, this is in the templates for the three types of trademark or copyright complaints. And this is what we have now, what we're working from now. We have a good faith statement under penalty of perjury or notarized and accompanied by sworn statement, and it's about the basis for reasonably believing that there's infringement going on. It's making a promise about how you will use the information that you obtain. And then we're getting hung up a little bit on whether there should be a third paragraph here, what the legal relationship is and the nature of the authority to speak for the trademark owner or the in the other template for the copyright owner. So we've had some discussion, and I know there was proposed that there be certain titles or certain roles that would be the only ones allowed to make this request. There was a good deal of pushback against that. And then we have this other language about stating the legal relationship and his or her authority and whether that is sufficient. Let me just throw two other possibilities into this mix. One is, again, along with the ban on automation or the discouragement of automation, would it make sense to make as part of this statement that the requester has personally reviewed the material that's the basis for the request, and that's the basis for the reasonable belief that could be incorporated into the A language, based on personal review or something like that? Is that something that would enable a greater degree of confidence in the attestation? And then the other thing is that the way this is drafted, it's not clear whether, we might need to make it clear that in some way that the statement under perjury or accompanied by a sworn statement notarized actually also goes to this assertion of agency. It goes to the state, to the not only to what the basis is and the promise about how you would use the information, but also in some way to the authorization that the requester has. Those are just two ideas to get perhaps stimulate some more discussion on this and see if we can make some progress on it. I see Volker has his hand up, and I'd welcome anybody else who wants to get in the queue, but for now let me turn it over to Volker.
Hi, Steve. I think you made some very good points here already and took some of what I was wanting to say. I'm certainly not married to the language that was proposed. It was just an effort to encapsulate the thought process that we had gone through to make sure that the proposed that someone who knows what he's doing is behind this and who has some authority to bind the entity making the claim to make a statement that would be could be attacked in court. So basically, what we're looking for is some form of authorization that would be binding on the principal, and some form of making sure that the person who is making the complaint knows what he's talking about.
Thank you.
Hi, Steve. This is Kieran. Can I get back in the queue at some point?
Yes, you can, and then we'll have Kathy after you. So go ahead, Kieran.
Hi. I have another question. Some of the language that's being proposed is, or not language that's being proposed, but I guess statements that are being made, I just don't really understand. So I guess I would. This question is directed to Volker. What exactly do you mean by they know what they're talking about? Because, you know, obviously in a situation where somebody has agency to speak on behalf of another in those matters, you know, it's up to the person who gave agency to appropriately train that person and then, of course, to accept liability and responsibility for the actions of the person that they gave agency to. And, you know, frankly, somebody can be an attorney or a CEO or a president, and, you know, every other person on the street in San Francisco is CEO of some sort of startup. That doesn't mean that they know what they're talking about, in my opinion. So perhaps you can explain to me in more detail what you mean by that, so that, you know, we could possibly wrap our head around this in a narrow enough way that we can get to some sort of resolution. Thank you.
Volker, do you want to respond briefly to the question to clarify?
Yes. Basically, what I mean by that is that if I'm a provider and I get a complaint, I want to be able to follow the trail. I want to see who gave the order, who made the research, who is sending this, who are you who are sending this in relation to the person who has the title or the right that is claimed to be infringed upon, what's the trail, and if possible, also evidence of how this right has been, is derived and how since when it exists. So evidence, basically provide us with as much information about the case that you can. Tell us who you are, tell us who authorized you, under what authority you're operating, and how to get back, what kind of contracts are between there. So we do not want to say have someone who has just been asked to do that. We want to see someone who has been granted to act on behalf with the voice of the principal in some form or shape. That can be contractual, that can be an officer of the principal, that can be an agency relationship, but that should be evidence.
Okay. Thank you, Volker. I would just say in terms of part of what you're saying, you know, tell us about the basis for this. This is what paragraph A of these templates is addressed to. Provides a basis for reasonably believing that the use of the trademark and the domain name as an infringement is not defensible. So presumably that would come there, and if you didn't have that, then you wouldn't necessarily have to act on this. But I thank you for clarifying what you're looking for here. Let me. I've got Kathy, and then I've got James Gannon and Paul McGrady. So Kathy, please go ahead.
Great. Thanks. And I, you know, as you know, we think this is a very important discussion. Okay, so the real question, I think, is does agent or the term authorized representative, we've been doing both, do they serve the purposes, the high level that Volker is talking about? And an agent or an authorized representative, unless I'm completely wrong, and please stop me if I am, can be a secretary, a clerk, a consultant. If we really want to bring that level of trust into the relationship, into the document, into the presentation, into the request that we're talking about, attorney is kind of the shorthand word that people use around the world for that kind of for a person representing a company, speaking with the authority of that company because there's an attorney-client relationship, and presumably speaking with some authority in the field in which they are presenting. So you wouldn't want a real estate attorney presenting a copyright infringement claim. And attorneys are bound by separate rules of ethics in order not to do that. Real estate attorneys know they're not allowed to present copyright infringement claims unless they happen to be one of the unusual experts in both fields. So the reason we also have officers of the corporation was because it was presented last week and we had actually anticipated it, was that some small businesses, certainly trademarks and copyrights can be owned by individuals and owned by small businesses, that would not want to go to the expense of hiring an attorney for this purpose, in which case an officer of the corporation has the high level of trust, knows the trademark and copyright, and, you know, one presumes that they could make the attestation, the signature. We're not saying that the president of Facebook has to do it. This is kind of, president of Facebook will go through his attorneys. This was an opening provided for small businesses. So I put language into the chat room that I had put into the email that we had been discussing, and it's a much more narrow presentation. And the reason why is not just because of who's signing this presentation, but who's receiving the data. And the customer and the provider, I don't think we want to go, speaking as a customer, as a registrant, if my data is revealed through an improper channel because a consultant or someone without proper authorization and expertise requested it, and then I have to track down the consultant and challenge the agency, that's not really a fair burden. My data should be revealed to the legal representative or the official representative of the company requesting it, and then there's some accountability. Thanks.
Thank you, Kathy. James Gannon, and then Paul McGrady.
Steve, this is Val.
Thanks, James.
Val, I'll put you in after Paul.
Thanks.
Go ahead, James.
Brilliant, James Gannon. I think as somebody who's came to this discussion later on than many of the people who are discussing it at the moment, I might have a little bit of perspective. I think what this is, it's not necessarily a discussion about an individual title or role needing to be attached to the request. What this is about is applying a certain standard of practice and a strong, strong assurance that this reveal request has actually been considered at a sufficient level within a company, and that it's not something that an intern has came up with or something that has been just done as part of a standard business practice by a low-level employee, that the gravity of what the request is has been considered by the company which is putting in the request, or the IP owner, or the authorized agent. It's about the gravity of the request and having that reflected in the requestor.
Thank you, James. Paul, and then Val. Volker, I see your hand is up. Did you want to be in the queue again? No.
Sorry, old hand.
Paul, and then Val.
So I think we're sort of now going, you know, around and around this issue, and I don't know how to resolve it because the notion that companies who have a problem are going to have to either track down somebody who is an executive of the company to sign a complaint like this, or always pay outside counsel to do it, which, by the way, would be the full Employment Act for me. So I'm speaking against my own economic interest here. That notion is just, it's a non-starter. This is not how corporations run. It doesn't give any credence to the idea that someone who is not an officer of a company might actually understand their job and what they're doing. And it also is not based in the reality of the volume of problems that big brands have. If we had, you know, if each corporation had one of these complaints to file a year instead of dozens a day or whatever they're doing, that's making them you know, automate this, you know, go out to vendors and other folks, then that, you know, that would be a different situation. But unfortunately, the abuse level out there is way too high to justify going to a corporate officer each time or spending you know, going to outside counsel each time that that corporate officer is unavailable. I share everybody's concerns about low-end providers who maybe don't know what they're doing, but some of these providers do have in-house counsel who review these things. Again, not speaking to that business model or trying to defend it because it's not my particular business model. I don't think we have to reach that issue. I think the issue that needs to be reached is it practical to expect corporate officers to be available to sign these things, or in the alternative, each time that one of these needs to be signed, if that corporate officer is not available, then it has to go outside to outside counsel. Essentially, that level will ensure that brand owners can't use this mechanism, and it's not, it's simply not a standard that's going to get any buy-in from the branding community. So we need to figure out where the, you know, where the line really is and start to, you know, come up with new ideas, because we're stuck here and we've been stuck here for a couple of weeks. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. I think Val Sherman was next in the queue.
Hello, everybody. This is Val Sherman. I understand the concerns that are raised really on all sides of this. Several of us have mentioned before that using titles can, you know, is potentially dangerous, and for various reasons, various people perform these types of functions in different organizations, and they're not always attorneys, and so we don't necessarily want to exclude people that are competent but to speak to these matters, but that might not hold a certain title. I'm wondering, and I don't want to oversimplify it, but I'm wondering if perhaps the inclusion of, you know, maybe a statement that says something like, I am an authorized representative of the trademark owner, if it is not the trademark owner, of course, filing the request, incapable and qualified to speak to the matter, Siren, and maybe something to that end might help to just straighten the idea of the agency that whoever is submitting the request is qualified, authorized, and can bind the principal. I don't know if that would be helpful, but that's just one thought. Thank you.
Okay, Val, thank you for that suggestion. I'm going to Volker's back in the queue, so I will recognize him. Is there anybody else that wants to speak on this, or else we'll wrap up this part and move on to 3C? Volker, go ahead.
Actually, that's pretty close to what I would like to see happening, what I would like to see documented. In the end, we would like to hear from the complainant, this is who I am, this is who authorized me, and this is how I'm authorized to bind the principal in this matter. So if you have a general agreement with the principal that hands you the authority to bind him to make such claims, all the power to you. If the principal is willing to bind himself to that, that's good. But I need something more than what we have in current complaints, what we have in complaints where they just say, I'm an agent and you have to believe me.
Okay. All right.
Steve, this is Karen. Can I just make you a quick question?
Actually, I was going to raise a quick question too.
Yes, Kieran.
I was listening to Volker speaking, I was fairly certain that what we have in there actually represented what he requested, and then at the end he said he needed more than what what we had already presented in the document, and then at the end he said that he needs more than what's in there. So can I just ask that he propose specific language that we can look at instead of going back and forth on this? Because to be honest with you, I think that what we have, which is the information of the trademark owner and then the signatory and then a statement of agency that says that they are acting on behalf of the trademark owner with authority, does address the questions that he had. So I guess it would be better for me to see specifically what he wants, because I think that his points are very good. I just don't see how the language that we've proposed doesn't actually meet those requirements.
Okay, I will make that request to everybody that's contributed here, but specifically to Volker and to Val, who had some language that she was reading. Please put this on the list, and let's see if we can. And since I put forward some concepts too, I will also put some language forward on the list. So please let's do this. I think it's clear that some of the language that's been put forward previously about corporate officers and so forth is not going to achieve consensus on that. And then simply leaving it open as it was in the original, where it's just a statement from a trademark holder and authorized representative without even any attestation that you are the authorized representative, isn't going to fly either. So I would encourage people to translate what they've said on this call, and you know, if you need to look at the transcript, fine. And let's get some of these ideas going, because I think we have some. We're approaching some level of agreement, but we can't really do this until we have concrete language. Kathy's going to have the last word, and then we're going to move on to 3C.
Steve, I think the path you just laid out makes a lot of sense, and some kind of evidence would be useful. We're not talking legal, you know, courtroom evidence, but how do we know that the trademark owner has agreed to this if a third party is presenting? So I'm with Volker. We do need additional language here. We're not there yet. Thanks much. Bye-bye.
Thank you, Kathy. Okay, so I seem to have dropped out of the room here, but I'll try to get back in. Okay, I'm back in. So I think we're going to move on to 3C now. And we've got several people have homework assignments on this agency attestation. The one other thing we needed to mention before we move on to 3C is the annex. Again, this was to deal with the problem of false when information has been revealed based on false pretenses. Mary's put up on the screen a red line of this. I think we haven't even really had full discussion of the original annex, and this makes a very substantial change. But because these are intended to be, as I think those who prepared the original proposal can confirm, these are intended to be options. One option is arbitration, and one option is submitting to jurisdiction, and they're not layered on top of each other, which it appears from this draft that it is. Because of that, I'm going to suggest that defer our discussion. I mean, I'm happy to take comments on the annex or questions on the annex, but we may want to defer our discussion of it and again, look at the original text. That's what this was intended. This was intended to be a further safeguard against the risk of requests based on false information. Kathy, is that an old hand or a new hand?
Old hand, Steve. I'll take it down.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. All right. So let's come back to the annex during the week, and let's turn now to 3C, which is thank you. It's back up on the screen now, and if you scroll down to, I guess, page 7, you see this. And this is the non-exhaustive list of reasons for non-disclosure. And you see some new language there on 5, which I think, again, Todd was may have been the source of. It seemed clear that with a lot of the discussion we were having about the level of proof that was needed or whether the request came up short, a big concern was this idea that even if there was a perfectly valid claim of trademark or copyright infringement, that wasn't really what was motivating the request, and the request was being motivated by an improper purpose, and that if there was evidence of that, shouldn't the provider be in a position to refuse the request? So I think that's what this new language on 5 is intended to get to. Ask Todd if you have any, because I believe you were the one that posted this language, if you have any introductory remarks you want to make on it. And then this is one where people have had at least a few days on the list to look at it. I think this was posted on Friday, so I'd welcome people's comments on it. Well, we'll start with Todd, and anybody else, please indicate if you want to get in the queue. Thanks.
Sure. Thanks, Steve. Again, this was an exercise in trying to find language that narrowly addresses the hypotheticals that we were discussing. There was a lot of discussion on what the standard ought to be, whether we should look to the URS, slam dunk, things like that. And, you know, my concern was that discussion of the standard as a kind of means of addressing the potential harm of requesters submitting a pretextual complaint in order to get contact information to then somehow harm the human rights of the beneficial user was just an ill fit. It was not going to catch everything that it was supposed to, and in doing so, it was actually going to block complaints that had nothing to do with pretext. So this new draft language is an attempt to kind of, again, more narrowly tailor what we are doing to the problem that we are trying to account for. But again, I'm certainly happy to discuss the language itself and wordsmithing of it. Thanks.
Thank you. So any comments on Todd on C5 that's at the top of page 8 on this text? I've got Kathy and Volker, and if anybody else wants to be in the queue, please raise your hand in Adobe or speak up if you're not in Adobe. Kathy, go ahead.
Sure, thanks. I think this language is good. I would clarify human rights with including freedom of expression and freedom of association, the kinds of pretextual issues we've been talking about over time. But I just wanted to point out that, and Mary shared with me the full text markup, that Todd's excellent language is replacing a lot of other language that we had talked about, and I'm not sure if it's an or an and, whether it should be replacing it or including it. So I just wanted to point out that, as he mentioned briefly, that we've been talking about a standard of evaluation here, a standard for of slam dunk or clear and obvious infringement that provided a different type of protection for providers, especially if this goes up to some kind of review process. And what this also replaced was the whole discussion that we had in here and that some of us liked, and there was a request to kind of keep it into the public comment period about the human rights issues, the complex case evaluation. So I'm not sure Todd's language should be replacing all of the language that was taken out with it. I think we really should be keeping that human rights complex case evaluation language to at least alert the community to the types of concerns that we've raised and that we'd like them to evaluate as well. And I would like to ask the providers whether a standard would be useful for the evaluation, because here we're taking it out. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you, Kathy, and we would welcome. I see we have a provider in the queue. Maybe he's going to respond to that. So we have Todd and then James Bledel. Todd, go ahead.
Well, just real quick to answer. No, I did intend it as an or, precisely for the reason that I was just outlining, that I think it more narrowly gets to the potential problem. Now, we can debate whether it should be an or for the previous language that was in C5 in terms of slam dunk, et cetera, separate from whether it should be an or from the essentially appendix that we have before on human rights cases. And perhaps it would be useful to do those separately. But no, certainly the intent behind it was that it was an or to more narrowly get to the problem that we were trying to solve.
Okay. James, go ahead.
Hi, good morning. James speaking. This may be a tangent here because I don't necessarily find myself disagreeing with the intent behind this this new language. But just thinking down the road here, this policy or this idea will be implemented in the form of a contract between a commercial party and ICANN. And I'm just concerned that I believe this will be the first instance where some third party that is not a signatory to that contract has an acknowledgement of rights and human rights at that. So, I mean, it just feels like we're tap dancing into a minefield here by inserting something that ambiguous into a commercial agreement between ICANN and a service provider. And I'm just a little concerned about that. I'm wondering if there's a way we can capture the intent without using that specific language. Thanks.
Okay. Thank you. We welcome your thoughts about how to do that. Again, I think Todd was responding to the articulated concern about this that had been brought up by several members of the several members of the working group. I see Volker's hand. Does anybody else want to be in the queue at this point? Go ahead, Volker.
I'm reading this for the first time, so I'm a bit behind. I'm a bit concerned about the demonstrating. Demonstrating seems to me, maybe that's because I'm not an English native speaker, but demonstrating seems to me that this almost rises to the level of evidence, whereas I would be, as a provider, rather in a position where reasonable doubt would be sufficient, reasonable doubt about the complaint's intent would be sufficient to move ahead. So I'm just thinking if that word might be changed or should be changed, but that's just something I wanted to throw out there for discussion.
Okay, thank you, and folks are welcome to respond to that point. I see Stephanie's hand. Does anybody else want to be in the queue at this point? Go ahead, Stephanie.
Hi, thanks. Stephanie Perrin for the record. I just wanted to respond to James Bledel's remark about his lack of comfort with the human rights language. Two things. Number one, some of these human rights are guaranteed in law, and therefore the inability to make reference to them, I think, is a problem. Let me give you an example. In Canada, we change identities of individuals who we have found are entitled to protection because they're being pursued by religious groups or estranged spouses. Previous language that we had in there demanding that they give some sort of justification for why they need a privacy proxy registration would in fact violate the terms of the commitment they made to the government to change their name and their social insurance number. I just give that as one example. Rights are for everybody. And unfortunately at ICANN, the only right, human right, that really has been recognized in the contracts to date has been the right of copyright. And I know some people persist in bringing it up that copyright is a human right. Sure, it's in there. But what about all the other ones that we haven't done anything about? So I would say that given that this is the first time ICANN has made an effort to regularize the use of privacy proxy services, we cannot leave out the human rights language. Thanks. And I would say that there's, you know, other parties attempting to get ICANN to comply with the Ruggies principles. That's a whole other volley coming in from a different quarter, and we can discuss whether or not ICANN should be subject to the Ruggies principles. But let's at least respond to some of the things that come up in the context of the very subject we are talking about. Thanks.
Okay, thank you, Stephanie. Volker, is that an old hand, or do you want to comment?
I'm going down now.
Okay. Well, let me just pull in a couple things together here. First of all, in terms of whether this is a standard substitute for the standard, again, remember the context of this, which is C, disclosure can be reasonably refused for reasons consistent with the general policy stated herein, including but not limited to any of the following. So there's a lot of reasons here. This is a non-exhaustive list, and at least in the current form, 2 and 3 are quite broad. About adequate reasons against disclosure, and I don't know whether that's that language is final either. But this is I think the if you go back to the preamble to this, one of the things we're trying to achieve is an adequate level of discretion for providers. So I think they have a lot of flexibility here. They may not it may not even be strictly speaking necessary to address the human rights issue, but I think, as Stephanie has pointed out, that there may be some good reasons for doing so, for listing that this is another basis upon which disclosure can be refused if this standard is met. On demonstrating, I think that's worth Volker's point about that's worth thinking about whether that's the right word there. I think it's a good word because it says you can't just base this on somebody saying my human rights are being violated, therefore don't disclose, even though I have no defense to copyright or trademark infringement. But if there needs to be some facts on which the human rights concern is based, I don't know how to respond quite to Stephanie's example of people in the witness protection program or something who've been issued new names and new social insurance numbers, but presumably what they would be asked to reveal here is their new name, not their old name. So it wouldn't go beyond that. But I think there seems to be some general support for Todd's approach here, and I would ask people if they have tweaks to this language that they want to suggest or a cogent reason why it shouldn't be included, then please bring that forward on the list as soon as possible. I also want to, and Mary, thank you for reminding me. Marika had raised in the chat earlier that some of these questions that we're wrestling with about including the agency attestation question and so forth may have been dealt with in CCTLDs. I don't know if people have information about that or whether that's something the staff can reach out to the staff contacts at the CCNSO and see if there's any information that we can draw on there, but that could be a useful comparison to make. Volker, I see your hand up again, so I assume you want to get back in the queue.
Yes, Steve, just to respond to your comments regarding what I said before. I think I posted this in the chat. If we could change specific evidence demonstrating to the word sufficient information to assume, that would, or maybe to assume could be made stronger, but it should be a certain level of information that has to be provided to make that assumption. But it should be more than just hearsay, but it should not need to be evidence, because once we go into the field of evidence having to be provided, I think reasonable belief is sufficient in this case. That's what I wanted to say. Thanks.
Okay, thank you. So the concern might be with evidence rather than and not just demonstrating. So we might say facts and circumstances if we want to avoid the legal sounding word evidence. You could say something like specific facts and circumstances showing that the
For example, yeah, yeah.
This is a pretext, so maybe that's something that could be considered. Paul McGrady.
This is Paul McGrady for the record. Just to beat the my standard drum again, this is an area where we appear to be having two different standards, where one party is being asked to sign under oath and running down and finding a notary and all this other stuff, and then the other party is, you know, we're concerned about not even using the word evidence. Again, maybe we don't need to use the word evidence, but maybe we don't need the other higher standard for the other party either. I just, again, would like for us, as we're building in these standards, to ask ourselves, why do we have different standards for a complaining party than we have for a responding party? So far, I've not heard any good explanation for that. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Paul. All right, so we're near the top of the hour here. I think we've covered a lot of territory. We're asking people to provide any tweaks to the language that Todd had presented just before this call regarding automation. We have a couple of people who I think are on the hook to come up with some language about attestation or agency that can get us out of the gridlock we're currently in on that topic. And I think there were some good suggestions there, and I hope people will come forward with that language. We have reserved the discussion of the annex, and I apologize for the change in the agenda, but I felt it was justified given the level and intensity of the discussion that we had on the list just in the hours leading up to this call. And then on this one, I think there's some agreement in principle, or there's a level of agreement in principle on this, what's now in here as number five, but there have been some wording changes suggested or floated, again, I encourage people to look at the whole section and see how this fits together as one in a list of non-exhaustive list of reasons for which disclosure can be refused. Is there anything else that people wish to raise on either this pretext language or on the attestation agency language before we wrap up? If not, I want to thank everyone for their participation, and I think we had a good substantive discussion and a good tone of discussion here. And as I said at the outset, sometimes we just need to take a deep breath and look past some of the colorful language that people sometimes tend to use on email lists and so forth. So let's not get too hung up on that. Let's maybe the deep breath approach will lower the incidence of that colorful language. But let's also kind of put that in the context and try to respond to the substance. I think people did, in my view, an excellent job of that today. So since we're just about at the top of the hour, we will wrap up here. Looking forward to a lot of activity on the list this week, and to talking to everybody again next Tuesday.
Great.
Thanks.
Thank you very much, Steve.
Thank you very much.
Francesca, if you can please stop the recording. Once again, our meeting has been adjourned. Thank you very much for joining, and please remember to disconnect all remaining lines.